Welcome to the Lifting Lindsay podcast. Man, today I am super excited to be here with Dr. Darren Kando, and we're going to be talking about all things creatine. Is that right?
That's the plan, yeah.
Awesome. Okay, I'm going to have you introduce yourself to my listeners. Just tell me a little bit about your background and how come you are the person to talk to about creatine.
My name is Darren Kando. I'm a professor in the Faculty of Kinesiology and Health Studies at the University of Regina in Canada. I have a few degrees. I did an undergrad degree in biology at Acadia University in Canada as well. And my graduate degrees were at the University of Saskatchewan under the mentorship of Dr. Phil Chilibeck. So a lot of people in the creatine area will know that name as well. And I kind of got into creatine supplementation through a colleague. I was doing my master's on an amino acid called glutamine. And he was interested in the organic acid creatine, and glutamine ended up being sort of worthless. And I got, you know, a little sad and dejected. And then I started to know really beneficial effects with creatine, primarily in young adults. And then it sort of paved the way for going from athletes all the way to clinical populations, from elderly to specific focal points. So it's been very interesting where around the 1990s, creatine sort of got its momentum. Then it went away after we thought we knew everything. And now I'm sure we'll talk about today the very diverse aspects that creatine can be used. Is it for everybody? Things like that. So excited to be here, and thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, I'm so excited about this. So yesterday I posted on Instagram, what questions, concerns do you have about creatine? It's interesting because I got so many very, very good questions, I feel like. But it's interesting because as a coach, a hypertrophy fat loss coach, I work with both men and women. And it's interesting because I'll tell men to start taking creatine. They don't have a problem with it. They don't think twice. Awesome. Do it. Women, it's like, no, let me pull out a whole list of reasons why I cannot do this. It's horrible for me. So I'm so excited to have you on here, and we're just going to break down everything. But I want to start from the very, very, very bottom, like the very, very foundation. What is even creatine?
So creatine is technically an organic acid. It's kind of like a protein that we would eat. It's very similar. It's made actually from reactions involving three amino acids from all the protein foods that we do eat. So we naturally produce this little compound in reactions in the kidneys and liver and the brain. So where everybody that's listening is synthesizing this compound at about 1 to 3 grams per day. We also consume about a few grams through red meat, seafood, or poultry. So I think later on we'll talk about, is it a difference between vegans and vegetarians versus those on a carnivore or omnivore diet? But I think most people are very familiar with the powder, creatine supplementation they see on stores or on social media. So at the end of the day, this compound, it was discovered in 1832, basically helps assist energy of our cells. So when we're exercising, shoveling the driveway, running, lifting weights, this little compound helps sacrifice itself, so to speak, to help maintain energy, to allow us maybe to do a little bit more work. And then if we do more work in the gym or on the track or wherever it is, over time, you start to notice adaptations. So it used to be called creatine makes an individual bigger, stronger, faster. But now it's taken on a whole nother pivoting perspective from the health aspects. And yes, females are very, very hesitant to take creatine. We can take or talk about why that is, why we think it is, and some ways that we may be able to sort of get across the stigma and sort of get individuals to consider it.
Okay, so let's talk about that then. Why is it that females are so hesitant? What have you heard that they struggle with?
So it's based on three things. So the initial recommendations with creatine came out in the late 1990s. And they said, hey, this is kind of designed for athletes wanting to get bigger, stronger, faster. So let's go ahead and super saturate the body with creatine and see if it works. And yes, this is called the creatine loading phase. It's on all the supplement labels that you could buy. And what it means is they want you to take 20 grams a day for up to 7 days. Now, the interesting thing with creatine, it's an osmotic compound. That means it likes to shovel water from an area of high concentration to an area of low. So where is water found in our body? It's the bloodstream. And now it likes to take water from the blood into our muscles. So a lot of individuals would say, hey, geez, I've been on creatine for 5 days. I noticed on the scale, I went up by a few kilograms. My shirt or clothes feels a bit tighter, and I just feel a little bit bigger. And I say, well, that's kind of the physiology behind creatine because you're taking such a high dose. Now, to a young male, that might be great. To a young female, independent of your menstrual cycle, when you go on the scale and after 5 days, you've gained 5 pounds, very rare does a female say, I love this. More times in our lab, they say, I don't like this at all. And we'll talk about strategies how to alleviate that. So the first thing to be aware of, it's just acute water retention. It goes away after about 2 weeks. And primarily in females, this is great. When you take an individual, a young female or an older female, and you measure them before creatine, and then after a few weeks, even months, their weight is almost identical. So one thing to be rest assured is weight barely changes. But the other interesting thing is, leading to the second most popular reason why I think females don't take creatine, is they think it improves fat mass or increases body fat. We've now clearly shown with all the evidence, when you combine creatine and exercise, you get a decrease. It's very small, but you do get a decrease in body fat. So at the end of the day, if you put on lean mass, decrease fat mass, that's probably why weight will not really fluctuate. So I would highly recommend to any female watching that is sensitive to weight fluctuations, do not do the loading phase. I'll give you a strategy that we think is really beneficial, but does not cause that excessive amount of bloating or GI tract irritation is the other main reason during the loading phase.
What causes that with the GI tract? Because that's another one that I get a lot of questions about. It's like, yes, the water weight, the water retention, it drives body fat up. And then I had some gut issues with it.
Yep.
What can we do about that?
Yes. So creatine is a very unique compound. So the pH of our stomach is about 1 to 2.5 to 3 at best. So very acidic, hydrochloric acid, and we have a lot of enzymes. But creatine only starts to break down when pH is above that. So it remains intact. It sort of can get through the acid of our stomach very easily. But when it gets through the small intestine and then eventually wants to leave, it takes water with that. So it indirectly is taking water from the gastrointestinal tract or digestive tract. So that's why a lot of individuals may get diarrhea, some bloating or muscle cramping or some GI tract irritation as well. And that's why it's highly recommended to take an increase in fluid, primarily water, when you're on creatine. And again, if you're taking the loading phase, that's 10 times as much as we're probably making. It kind of makes sense. That's why it would have some adverse effects. So make sure we talk about probably an alternate strategy, which I think is more viable, that will maintain adherence and probably reduce the chance of bloating and water retention.
So I actually have never done a loading phase. I've taken creatine for years and years and years. Sure. I never did a loading phase. And so I never experienced a lot of these things that women are complaining about. But loading phases in, you know, the hypertrophy world are taught that that's the only way. And I usually tell women not to. So now I'm even more curious, what do you usually tell people to do?
So that's an important distinction. So the loading phase is super effective. It's the most rapid way to saturate your muscles. At the end of the day, we're probably starting out between 70 to 80% of our muscles are full of creatine. Supplementation may give you the extra 20 to 40%. So it's like your living room. It's 3/4 full of creatine. When you take a supplement, you get a bit more. So the loading phase is very effective, but as we just mentioned, some of those adverse effects. To help recruit or inspire people to take at a more consistent level, there's probably two other strategies that have been very well documented to be safe and effective. Let's start with the easiest. You can take as little as 3 grams a day, and that will fill up the room in about 30 days. So we talked about the loading phase after about 7 days, but actually after 2 days of the loading phase, your muscles are full, but usually studies will do 7 days. If you take as little as 3 grams a day for 30 days, that'll have the same effect. So now a female or young male listening say, wow, I can do the loading phase if I want, or I can take a really small dose, just need to be a little bit more patient. So for those considering creatine for the lifelong journey into health benefits, from a muscle perspective, again, this is not from a bone or brain, you can take as little as 3 grams a day. I'm sure even if you reduce it to 2, that would eventually accumulate. Now, here's the other cool thing. You can take 3 grams, which is a half a teaspoon at one serving, or you could probably break it up into 2 1.5 servings in the morning and evening. The timing is essentially irrelevant. You take it when it's convenient, but also one of the other things I recommend is to take it with food. So if you're having like yogurt in the morning, just throw it in there. There's no taste to creatine. You can drink it. But a lot of people in our lab, when we give it or recommend it with food, they say, yeah, I didn't even notice I was taking it. So again, 3 grams, you can bump it up to 5. But from a muscle perspective, 5 seems to be the maximal amount anybody on the planet may need. And that's without a loading phase. So that's no, you're just starting day one, 3 to 5 grams a day. That's plenty. It'll just take a little bit more time.
Okay. Is there another one? So the loading, what does the loading usually look like? Let's explain that one too.
Yeah, it's about 20 grams a day. And you break that up into 4 5-gram dosages for 7 days. Then on starting on day 8, you drop it down to about 2 to 5 grams a day to maintain what's in our muscle. We don't do that. We can and we will be looking at the really small dose like I talked about. The one that's most popular in our lab is a relative dose. So if me and you go on the scale and just say you're 50 kilograms and I'm 70, it's probably logical I might have a bit more muscle. That's the theory. Yeah. And so the bigger the muscle is, that has more of these doorways that allow creatine in. So we use 0.1 gram per kilogram all the way up to 0.15 gram per kilogram in older adults. So if we do the quick math, if you're 50 kilograms, you're only getting 5 grams a day. But I'm a little bit bigger, and just say if I was only 70 kilograms, I would get 7 grams a day. If you have a professional athlete, 100 grams or 100 kilograms, they get 10 grams a day. So we've understand the premise behind that, and we've shown that dose to be very safe and effective.
Well, that brings me to another view. Well, I have so many questions. Is it even necessary? Is it even beneficial if we already create and can get it from proteins? Like, why even if somebody just is lifting as a lifestyle, trying to lose a little body fat, is it even important for them?
Yeah, it's substantially not required in the younger years. You're naturally producing enough. And the best way to support this is, how are vegans and vegetarians so healthy without creatine? And it's because you're naturally producing it. So at the end of the day, is it absolutely required like protein? No, because we naturally can't produce it. We can't produce those 9 essential amino acids. But research has clearly shown that a slightly little bit more that accumulates can unlock the potential. But we don't know if that's the fact when you get into the 4th decade and above, when we're starting to have a reduction in muscle mass and natural brain creatine concentrations. Is creatine essentially required? There's some speculation it can be. But at the end of the day, if anything is being made in the body, in theory, it's not essential. So that's why it's not like protein where you need those essential amino acids.
But it is, we have so much research on creatine. I would say, I could be wrong on this, but more research on creatine than any other supplement that I've ever dealt with.
Yeah, it's taken over from caffeine now as the most researched ergogenic aid on the planet.
So we know the most about this. And what I find very interesting is that many doctors say that it's bad for kidneys. So I want to talk about it being bad for kidneys. Yeah. Another woman wrote to me and said her doctor said anybody under 18 shouldn't take it, that it will have adverse effects. And anybody over 30 shouldn't take it. So what you're talking about with age, we can actually see more benefits, I feel like, with older populations. If you can even call 30 old, come on.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
that was an interesting one from a doctor.
So this is, well, the one over 30 is nonsensical from an evidence-based perspective, but let's start with the kidney one. Cause that is probably the second most popular myth next to baldness, which if you look at me, it's like, oh God, it must go. We'll talk about that. So this is really important for those taking creatine or thinking of it. You need to tell your doctor, and I'm assuming your nephrologist or GP is going to have enough education during medical school to understand the basic principle. So when you take in creatine and it gets trapped in your muscle or brain, it gets broken down when you use it, but it does not get broken down as creatine. It gets broken down as something called creatinine. And everybody listening is like, oh, I just saw that name on my blood requisition form. And you're like, oh, I kind of now understand. So please note, when you take creatine supplementation, it's highly likely you're going to have an increase in something called blood creatinine. And they use this metabolic byproduct to estimate kidney function. So it's kind of like a water filter on a Brita or something you're drinking. If the filter is not working properly, things are going to accumulate in the reservoir of the water bottle, or in this case, your bloodstream. So creatine does often lead to high blood creatinine, which gives a false positive or indication that your kidneys are failing. when you stop taking creatine, everything goes back to normal. So you could conclude it's the supplement just being broken down and metabolized. Now, as again, I'm not a medical practitioner, but from the physiology, it does make sense. If you take creatine, you're going to have more of this in the blood, and that gives a false positive that your kidneys are not working. So make sure you please tell your doctor that so there's no alarm and stress. The second part of your question is in children. So there hasn't been a lot of biomedical evidence from a blood perspective in children, but there's good researchers in the United States that have clearly shown creatine at recommended dosages, maybe 3 to 5 grams, has been very safe from a subjective standpoint. No GI tract irritation, headaches, nausea, excessive weight gain, anything like that. And it has been shown to improve sport and exercise performance. They're currently looking at blood right now, and that paper will come out shortly. But I would be shocked, to be honest, if there's any adverse effects, because we've already talked about it. Our body recognizes it. Our body produces it. A little bit more just will be excreted down the toilet. For the doctor who said above 30, people shouldn't take creatine, that actually goes against all the entire body of research. If any population that may want to consider it is as you get older, because creatine is primarily found in our large muscle fibers. We actually see a reduction in the amount of creatine in our muscles, and we have heightened metabolic stress with bone loss and abnormalities in brain function with aging. And that's where creatine seems to have an effect. So maybe the doctor misspoke, but after the age of 30 is when you really should be considering it, not considering it.
That's really fascinating. When we talk about sports muscle, a lot of us know, okay, this can be beneficial.
Yes.
But we've come to find that it exceeds that, right? So let's talk about some of the other benefits that we're finding in creatine.
Okay, yeah. So in brief summary, in combination with exercise, primarily weightlifting, it's definitely been shown to improve muscle mass, strength, and performance. It also has improvements now in a novelty of improving exercise recovery, even for the aerobic athletes. So that's a new area of population for soccer and running and ultra marathon. It really seems to improve recovery. They allow you to continue to participate. The big area, especially for young females leading into older phases, premenopause, perimenopause, and postmenopause, is we've now clearly shown that creatine in combination with exercise has very favorable effects on the skeleton, primarily bone strength and bone mineral density around the hip region. And that's an area that if you were to fall and get a hip fracture, it leads to inactivity and immobilization. So there's some promise now in older individuals. We don't see a lot in younger, probably because the skeleton is already so healthy. But that's an area for postmenopausal females for sure, that creatine in combination with exercise can have some small but yet favorable effects. And I think the biggest area is the neck up. We're now seeing some good promise for cognition and memory in older adults. It's been shown to speed up recovery in concussion in children. And now there's hope it can have some improvements in neurological conditions such as Alzheimer's, dementia. So I think the next 20 years will go not from the neck down, but the neck up. And then the other big area is pregnancy. A good researcher in Australia is now looking at the benefits not only for the female, but during fetal development. Yeah. So it's become this whole body, all population health product.
So I'm pregnant.
Okay.
So I'm really interested in the pregnancy part, but that one is kind of hard because from what I see, we really only have published like looking at rats. And
yes.
So nothing I believe has been published as far as pregnancy with humans.
So first off, you got to talk to your medical practitioner. Anytime we're dealing with a special population and very special regarding pregnancy, fetal development, make sure you talk to your doctor multiple times that this is okay for you. You're right. The majority of the promise has come from the mice and rodent model. There's been a few studies in children or during development, and it all comes back to the same mechanism. It potentially enhances the energy capacity for the mother and fetus, but it also seems to decrease inflammation. So sometimes during hypoxic environments, stillborn or catastrophic events there, it seems to have improvements in brain bioenergetics. Again, you're totally right using the animal model. So it's an emerging area. Stacey Ellery in Australia is the leader in this. And if you just Google her name, you can get free access.
I have Googled her. Yeah.
She has some really exceptional papers. They use a sheep model. They use the mouse model. There's some promise there. But one interesting thing you'll notice in all her studies or papers is that the current body of research suggests there's no greater adverse effects. Again, we're naturally producing it, but again, caution is severely warranted. We don't know if creatine will transition into the breast milk. We don't think so, but that's an area that's going to have to be looked at in human clinical trials. But it's very difficult to do. You need to get ethical approval. And again, it's such a dangerous area, a potential good promise. I think make sure you get medical approval and screening with that is for sure.
You know, what's hard though is when a lot of doctors will tell women still like, well, don't weight lift during, don't, no resistance training, know this. So it's sometimes it's hard going to your physician because it's like, what are you going to tell me? Are you going to be old school and say, I can't lift anything over 20, so then I can't even lift my own children? Yeah. Or are you going to be a little bit more aware and realize that I'm not handicapped during pregnancy and I'm still quite capable?
Yeah. And we now know, and that's like, you know, you shouldn't exercise when you're a child. So you know, some, unfortunately, medical practitioners, they know a little bit about a lot of things and are Googling a lot of things as well. And when you get bad advice as the doctor smoking outside, you're wondering, you know, what's really going on? But at the end of the day, they have the highest capability and liability to give the advice. There's a lot of good evidence-based research articles out there that are freely accessible. But at the end of the day, they can be very daunting to read. But for anybody considering supplementation, make sure it's right for you. Only rely on evidence-based research. That's those journal publications. Do not rely on influencers trying to peddle a product that may or may not have other ingredients that can cause harmful effects. Creatine is naturally produced in our body, and that's probably why the safety profile is very, very high. We have another massive paper coming out. There's 17 authors on it, looking at part two of all these myths and misconceptions, and male infertility and pregnancy is in there. And that should be published by the end of the year. It'll be a very popular paper.
I'm really excited for that. That will be so helpful.
Yeah.
Now, what about, there are different types of creatine that are being sold. So are there any benefits? Is it just regular creatine monohydrate? Like, is that kind of the good go-to, or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no matter how cool the label looks, how much marketing, what someone tells you, nothing as it currently stands comes close to monohydrate. And the reason being is monohydrate, meaning one water molecule linked to this creatine molecule, it comes in through our stomach and it's easy to digest it because the water molecule is dissolved and it goes to your bloodstream. That creatine molecule is going to be identical to what we're naturally synthesizing. And that's why it's safe and very effective. But all these marketing forms of creatine, I often question, because creatine bioavailability is almost 100%. How can you get better than 100% and shown to be safe and effective, and no other product has come close to it? So if you're out there and you go to a store and they say, oh, this is the best, you need a special creatine for women, you just say, no, I need the same for everybody. There's no magic. I don't need creatine hydrochloride or anything with a high buffering. No. Just take monohydrate and rest assured that's where all the evidence is supporting it.
I was reading through marketing strategy and they were saying that if you put four women on the label, you can increase the price by up to 40% and women will buy it.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. And it's the stuff I hear on Instagram, especially daily, I shake my head at. I'll be honest, the IOC only lists about five products that really have good evidence for improvements. One is beetroot juice and sodium bicarbonate, beta-alanine, caffeine, and creatine, protein as a macronutrient. And anything else is suspect, right? Until more evidence has been done. So if you look at those five, you're like, geez, I can get most of those products in red meat or seafood. I can get a lot of those compounds from eating a nice salad. So food first, sleep, adequate nutrition, and supplements will give a little bit better effect. And I always use this analogy. If the cake is exercise, the nice chocolate icing is protein. Nothing's going to be working without adequate protein. And then creatine are the sprinkles on it to allow the child to be enticed to eat it. And at the end of the day, exercise first. All supplements in that may give a small better effect, but sometimes that can have clinical applications moving forward.
Yeah. I always like to remind people that if you don't know how to work hard in the gym, then creatine is not going to help you work harder if you already can't work hard. Like, it is for those that are, like you said, have those box checked off.
Yes.
can really get in there, work hard, and then you can see some very slight benefits.
Yeah.
With
and to that point, there's been a handful of studies in younger individuals and older individuals when they don't have a resistance training or exercise component in the study. So creatine on its own. Creatine is one of those interesting ones. It has been shown to improve muscle performance without exercise, but it unlocks the great potential when it is combined with exercise. So you start to think, could creatine have application for long-term bed rest, immobilization during surgery? There's been some studies that have shown it preserves strength and muscle mass. But we think now some populations that may not be able to exercise, creatine has been shown, not nearly as much as in combination with exercise, but it has been shown to have some muscle benefits. And we also have now show some beneficial effects from cognition without exercise. So it seems to be an energy status molecule, but let's rest assured 90 to 95% of all the totality of benefits come with exercise. But there are some evidence that suggests you can still get creatine without exercise.
That's amazing. I do want to talk a little bit more of the cognitive benefits. Mm-hmm. What have we exactly seen? Because that's newer, I feel like.
Yes, it is.
That hasn't been talked about very much. It's usually just endurance, muscle. So talk on that point a little bit more.
Okay. So if you're taking creatine and you're well-rested, you're young, you have no metabolic stressors in your life, adequate sleep, nutrition, creatine is not going to give you any greater benefit from a cognitive or memory perspective. However, in populations that are sleep-deprived, jet-lag, aging, metabolic stress, which is almost anybody on the planet when you talk to, creatine has been shown to improve cognition, decrease symptoms of sleep deprivation, and that jet lag would fall into that category, and improve indices of memory and cognition in the elderly. So it has shown promise when the brain is metabolically stressed. When you look at the mechanisms, the brain uses creatine just like muscle. But this is something some of the viewers may not know. Creatine is not made in our muscle. It's made in the liver or kidney. But the brain actually does make its own creatine. So that's why we think if the brain is not stressed, the brain says, hey, I'm already making enough. I don't need supplementation. But during depression, anxiety, neurophysiological disease, concussion, there's a common denominator. The amount of creatine in the brain is reduced. So maybe the brain becomes more sensitive to take up creatine from the bloodstream and sort of compensate for what's happening. So that's why we see the best lines of evidence, although the body of research is emerging, when the brain is stressed.
Have you heard of creatine headaches? Is that common?
We've heard of that, but actually when you look at the data, if the person is hydrated, creatine decreases the incidence of headaches. Mm. And there's a couple of papers on long COVID where creatine had beneficial effects on decreasing brain fog and headache incident in those individuals. The same theory. The brain was compromised during COVID. The brain is more sensitive to repair or rehabilitate itself.
Oh, wow. That's incredible. Okay. Is there anything else before I'm going to look over and see if there's any other questions? I feel like you covered so many of the questions and concerns.
The other big one is, does it matter when I take it? And I'll preface this, that you can take it in the morning before your workout, during your workout, which I do. I put 5 grams in a water bowl and I just drink it. You can take it right after, before going to bed. So the timing is kind of irrelevant. There is the potential that caffeine at a high dose will interfere with the kinetics of creatine. Mm. So I need to be careful how I preface this because people have heard this and sort of immediately think caffeine, coffee. The dose is about 200 milligrams. That's going to be a large coffee, depending on where you're at in the world, on a consistent basis. There's been cellular research and a subjective research to suggest that maybe caffeine and creatine oppose each other at the cell level. So it may be advisable to have your coffee or tea or high dose caffeine before you work out. And the cool thing is creatine can be taken after or at any other time of the day. So that's usually my personal recommendation.
Okay. Well, that was another one of the questions that I got was how does caffeine interfere?
Yeah.
Can you have it in your coffee? Because a lot of people just do that.
So you can, because the dose of caffeine is going to be low. But if you're dumping it in a large Starbucks or whichever with 400 milligrams of caffeine every day, and then you're sipping on it, there's a good chance the acidic environment from the caffeine or the heat will degrade some of the creatine, which may not cause a greater efficacy. We now know that creatine and caffeine don't oppose each other from uptake, but they seem to, there's something there at the cell level. It has to do with calcium, that there's there's some probability that they could interfere with each other. We don't really know for sure, but when we have evidence to suggest they could, why not just spread it out? But if putting your creatine in your coffee is the only way you're going to adhere to it, go ahead. I'm sure you're going to get the same effects.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Is there anything that you just wish more people understood about creatine?
I think now, knowing that it's not a steroid, if you do it correctly, it should not cause successive weight gain. And the other big thing, it's not a holy grail. I'm starting to get these questions like, oh, I can just take creatine and I'm going to cure everything. I'm going to steal this from another individual. It sort of acts as the Swiss Army knife of supplements. It kind of has a little bit of everything going on. But you've already touched on, you have to exercise. You're not going to get a lot of big benefits without it. So exercise first, protein second, of course, sleep, all that comes into play. But creatine will just give a small, better effect. Now, if you're clinically compromised, some individuals are born with some deficiencies in creatine or in the aging population, that's where creatine will probably have more application. But yes, if you're a young female, can you take creatine? 100%. I really struggle with anybody on the planet that would be not recommended to at least consider it. Can you get it through your diet? Yes, but you have to be on a red meat or seafood intake daily. Vegans respond exceptionally well because their muscles are only half full. So there's a lot of questions that remain, but I know it's really difficult to get young females, and that's 18 and above, to participate in research studies because of the outdated stigma on this supplement. It's not a steroid. It's kind of something we produce, but it almost seemed too good to be true, but because it has all these applications.
So as far as dosing for vegans, vegetarians, do you change the dosage at all? Do you encourage something else?
Yeah, no, I would stay with the same. It's going to respond and be trapped in the muscle a little bit quicker, and they respond exceptionally well. So if any vegan, vegetarian are emphasizing a plant-based diet, or even those that are not eating a lot of red meat anymore, you probably will become a responder, and that means your muscles will accumulate and trap it in, including the brain. Those on a carnivore diet who are eating, you know, steaks and seafood all day, you're probably going to be considered a non-responder. That means you're already eating so much that you might not need supplementation.
I love that. What about cycling? A lot of supplements you should cycle on and off. What about creatine?
So at a high dose intake, there is a theory that it would be advisable to cycle it because the higher the amount you take in, your muscle doorways sort of become closed or desensitized. I understand that, but I say, well, wait, if a trickling amount can go to your bone and brain, the higher dose may be advisable. There's never actually been a study comparing daily dose versus cycling. And in our longest trial, we gave creatine 11 grams a day for 2 straight years in postmenopausal females, and it was effective and there was no adverse effects. So at the end of the day, I think it's really what's up to the individual. If you want to cycle it and then go on vacation for a month, the cool thing is once your muscles are full, the elevated creatine stays for 4 weeks in your muscle, and it probably stays for about 5 weeks in the brain. So let's do an analogy. Hey, I worked as a student all term. Now I'm going to go to Mexico for 3 or 4 weeks. I don't want to bring the white powder across the border. Rest assured that that elevated amount of creatine will stay elevated. And then I'll give you 2 strategies you can do on vacation. Everybody should still be active when they're resting, so to speak. The more active you are, that'll help maintain creatine in the muscle. And then if you do eat red meat or seafood, emphasize that in your diet when you're on vacation, that'll put more creatine back in. So you can cycle it if you like, financially, whatever your preference. There's no real need to, but there's no evidence to suggest there's one that's favorable over the other.
So when your muscles are already loaded, is it okay just to, let's say I train 4 times a week, to just take creatine those 4 days?
Yeah.
Or is it still better daily?
And that's an excellent, we don't know that, but the theory is I used to just say, just, you know, we have evidence to suggest just taking on the days you work out. But if you're only doing it from a muscle perspective, I'm okay with that. But remember, those off days is when creatine may be going to the bone, maybe going to your immune system, maybe going to the brain. So now we recommend it on a daily basis.
So now we know more and there's more reason to take it too.
Yes,
so
there just, is.
Yeah, I love that. You mentioned hair loss for men.
Yeah.
And then another one somebody sent me, I don't know if you've heard this one before, but it can give men man boobs.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. So the first one, we'll start with baldness, and it's the most popular, it's even more popular question than the kidney issue. It was all based on a young athlete study where they took 20 grams of creatine a day, and it increased the hormone DHT, a derivative of testosterone. And when you go in the biology textbooks, DHT is highly linked to hair follicle loss and baldness. But in that study, they only measured serum DHT, which is not associated with hair follicle loss or baldness at the cell level. And in that study, they never measured baldness or hair thinning. All they simply measured was an increase in the hormone, but it fell within the normal range. Like when you go to your doctor and your cholesterol and blood glucose, there's a range. DHT fell within that too. So a lot of people say, oh, well, the hormone went up. That means why I'm going baldness. I'm like, no, you can base that primarily on your mother's chromosome and genetic material. You were probably going bald, or the etiology of it was occurring beforehand. I will flip it though. There's never been a study to say creatine doesn't cause baldness. So we need to actually study that, but you need to get a dermatologist to look at the number of cross-sectional areas of the hair in a certain area to measure, just like muscle mass. But as it currently stands, there's no evidence to suggest that it does directly. And I've assessed well over 1,000 people at higher dosages, and not a single person has ever come to me and say, my hair is thinning. The second one is regarding abnormal accumulation of water in certain areas of the body. Now, that can occur when they're doing excessive heavy weight with not enough protein, with a lot of carbohydrates in their diet. That's usually what is being implicated, where creatine traps water. And for every gram of carbohydrate you eat, you also trap 3 grams of water. So my guess is it's the accumulation of water retention.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. Now, you've done a lot of podcasts, I feel like. Mm-hmm. I feel like I see you on a lot of fitness, health podcasts. I love it. Is there ever a question that you just wish people would discuss more, that you wish that the general population knew about?
That's an excellent question. I've never gotten this one yet. I think the beneficial effects for older adults, or let's say non-athletes. I think a lot of people think it's just for athletes, and primarily it's not just for biological males. I wish females would become at least more open to it. And I think we're getting the information out there. And that's one of the main reasons I'll do all these podcasts, is to talk about evidence-based research. I just think by looking at the beneficial effects for potentially bone health, cognition, agility, balance as we get older, I think it's something to consider for everybody. The safety profile is excellent. Do we always need more data? Of course. And we need to do randomized control trials. That's the areas I think we have to get more awareness out there for people.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Darren, for coming on. This has been so helpful. You've answered every single time somebody sends me a question, I'm just going to send them this podcast now.
Sure. Yeah, that's right.
Because you pretty much nailed it. Okay. I feel like I have to repeat myself so much on this subject.
Yeah.
So this is.
Thanks for having me. And maybe near the end of the year, we'll do the myths and misconceptions part 2 and answer all the other questions that come in. But thanks so much for the opportunity. I had a great time.
Of course. You have a wonderful day.
Great. Thanks so much. Take care.